Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 41st episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, Audiobooks Help Us Understand the World. On this episode, I was joined by Dr. Emily Bashar, co-author of the book, Addictive Ideologies, Finding Meaning in Agency When Politics Fail You. In the book, Dr. Emily Bashar, a clinical psychologist, and Paul Johnson, entrepreneur and former mayor of Phoenix, Arizona, offer a word of caution, their belief that today's world of runaway identity politics, nationalism, and cancel culture is setting the stage for a loss of individual agency and liberty, keenly showing why we can't take democracy and civility for granted. Dr. Bashar tells the harrowing story of the persecution of Jews in Iraq by Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party through her family's own personal experiences. Building on Dr. Bashar's powerful historical context, Paul Johnson uses his own mayoral experiences to chart a path for the future that can avoid similar atrocities. This book draws upon an understanding of social divisions and clinical and social psychology to show the real power we have to promote constructive change. It was great discussing the book with Emily. I hope you enjoy the episode. You being a psychologist and Paul being in politics, add to that your family's history and experience of being Arab Jews in Iraq after World War II and during the time of the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party is brought to life and expressed very well throughout the book. How did your life experiences and identity of self help you to come to this point of co-authoring this book?
So we come from very different walks of life, Paul Johnson and I. He was the former mayor of Phoenix, Arizona, largest city in the U.S. And I work in the forensic setting as well as the clinical setting. I have a private psychology practice and I do full in-depth comprehensive psychological evaluations for people in the criminal court setting who are facing charges for terrorism, first degree murder, capital offenses. So they're potentially facing life sentences and very extreme conditions. So Paul and I were bridging and talking about different genocides and holocausts that have happened all over the world, really trying to understand, not just from the perspective of my family story of being Jewish minorities in Iraq, persecuted by the Ba'ath regime and Saddam Hussein, but really trying to understand various atrocities and what are some of the common themes and how have they persisted? How is it that people can come together to commit such horror and terror and human rights abuses among each other? And these may be for people who have lived relatively in peace for centuries, or maybe have always been conflicted because of social or cultural or religious divides or political divides or border divides. And so we really wanted to ask this question, like, what is going on in the human psyche? How is it that mass movements happen, that people can just be controlled by these authoritarian regimes or dictatorships? And we were looking at some other research by Philip Zimbardo and Milgram after World War II, who were really questioning, how is it that you could get good people to turn bad and commit such horrific atrocities and human rights abuses and just turn savage on one another? And so these events did not happen without millions of people participating. And it wasn't just the leader. We can't put all the blame on the authoritarian or the dictator. Like, they needed supporters in order for them to gain the control and commit the atrocities that they did. And so that's what we were asking. Like, how did they manage to convince people and really mind control them to murder and torture other people? So what we found, and this was really essentially our hypothesis, was something unique that went beyond what Milgram and Zimbardo were studying, was that terrorism and torture was tied to an ideology. And this is where we came up with the title of our book, Addictive Ideologies, How to Find Meaning and Agency When Politics Fails You. And what we're proposing is that these addictive or radicalized ideologies that lead to violence separate society from those who view themselves as victims to those that they see as outgroup members and those who they see as different from themselves and a potential threat to their identity. And three, that these ideologies and those affected by it show many of the same traits to those who are addicted, meaning that their brains are working the same and that they're controlled by fear. They're willing to promote violence and commit such horrific atrocities, but they're not really thinking rationally or logically. They're really overcome by a very primitive emotional limbic system response, namely that you just can't stop even though you know it's hurting somebody. So this is relevant because, you know, we wanted to really understand what's happening in the US and apply what these findings and results and conclusions based on what was happening in our broken democracy and threat to democracy, let's just say, in the US. And we're really concerned about all these diverging points of view and what's happening with the alt-right versus counterculture and the woke culture, really focusing on an oppressor and viewing oneself as oppressed. And so this is really a concern here, and we're proposing a solution, which is that we believe this includes political reforms, education reforms, although this wasn't really the main point and focus of our book. It was really looking at agency and promoting the individual, that every individual has an inherent responsibility and they have to be accountable for themselves. Because that's the only thing at the end of the day that you really have the power and control to affect. And so we came up with these 7 ideals to really promote this sense of empowerment and control in order to protect one's individual and civil liberties and equality and justice.
Speaking on one's individual civil liberties and justice, how would you say these addictive ideologies absorb us of the responsibilities of ourselves?
So addictive ideologies, they serve to offer legitimacy, but it's through faulty cognitions and cognitive distortions. So I talked a little bit before about the amygdala hijack. I think that's a really important neurological process to discuss, because politicians use it, media uses it. Really, when we feel afraid or terrorized or paranoid, we look for quick solutions. And if the media or politicians or authoritarians are giving us the straw man or the person to blame or the out-group to shame and giving a very quick and simple rationale and reason for why they are a cause of all of your problems and losses and pains in your life, people will grab on and gravitate towards those, especially when they've inhibited their frontal lobe and they're activating their limbic system. So people are going in their fight, flight, freeze response. So that's why psychologists will often say, don't react, reflect, step back. There's no good in retributive justice, which is an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, a soul for a soul. And I've worked with so many people who have lost people in their lives, even having their children brutally murdered. And even they say, yeah, I might want the death penalty for the perpetrator, but that's not going to bring my child back. It might feel good for a moment, or it might not even feel like it's enough. Like, where would you stop at that point? And so we have to be accountable for ourselves. And this is where Paul and I are really promoting these 7 ideals that we talk about on our podcast, The Optimistic American, in that you have to be accountable for yourself. You can't just blame the out group or blame the other person for all of your problems. You really have to reflect and look within and find the truth and really promote rational thought, logical thought, look for the evidence, try and find disconfirming evidence for your beliefs so that you can find some middle ground, not just be persuaded by what someone is quickly telling you, especially if you're feeling anxious, terrified, or terrorized, or paranoid, or persecuted. And there's danger to having a victim mentality or having an oppressive mentality where you feel like you've been unjustly oppressed by this other group. These are very dangerous ideologies and mental frameworks, and you miss the blind spots. So you find these ways to justify and rationalize all kinds of very dangerous behaviors, and it's a slippery slope. And as we know with other research, Joyce Bellinger also wrote about these different kinds of obsessive ideologies and how they almost become impermeable and resistant to evidence that is counter to their beliefs because they're so emotionally invested and obsessed about proving that they're right that they disconfirm any alternative perspectives. And they almost live in a silo where they're not really allowing other people with divergent views to be penetrating the way that they see the world. And so all of that becomes very dangerous because it just becomes that slippery slope and justifying why this outgroup is wrong, justifying anti-Muslim rhetoric, justifying anti-Jewish rhetoric, justifying anti-immigrant rhetoric. And they just hold on to it like this is the only answer.
Paul said in the book that nothing makes an ideology more sticky than the feeling of indivisibility. How can the person feeling invisible be the catalyst for a potential disaster not far away?
We're seeing that in America, that there's groups of people feeling a lot of hatred and resentment, maybe envy, maybe jealousy. Maybe they feel like they've been treated unjustly and they feel like something's been taken away that they had. And Eric Hoffer talked about that. They said, you know, the groups that are most likely or most inclined to gravitate towards violence are those who had something and had it taken away from them because they want something restored back. And so leaders who can come in and provide these false promises of restoring what they once had, even though it's an illusion, it's like the person who feels invisible has this possibility and opportunity to be seen, and they'll gravitate towards that leader who can even provide those false promises. And I think that we are seeing that today in the US, and this is a great endangerment to our democracy today.
And what role would you say political leaders play in extreme ideologies, Emily?
So it's offering that false hope. So if I can maybe give my family example here, I think it would be an opportunity.
Absolutely.
So my parents, we've been in Iraq for generations. In fact, last Friday, a week ago today, was Holocaust Remembrance Day. And in addition to memorializing the liberation of the Auschwitz-Birkenau concentration camp in 1945, decades later, actually, in 1969, were these public hangings of Jews who were falsely accused of being spies for Israel, two of whom were only 17 years old. They were placed on these mock trials. They call them the Mickey Mouse trials because there was absolutely no evidence that they were conspiring against the state. But this was a ploy, and it was propaganda, and it was a tactic used by Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party in order to gain control and create this movement, which propelled some intense momentum for continued anti-Semitism and hate and violence towards the Jewish community that had been in Baghdad for many, many generations. So what happened after the hangings was Jewish assets were seized, bank accounts were frozen. It was like a witch hunt. Anyone could claim anything about any Jewish person if they wanted to go and rob them of their property and possessions. And my mother was on her way to school. All of a sudden, she saw that there were these groups of people in front of her school, and they were chanting and saying hateful things towards Jews, not permitting them to come into the classrooms. There were Arabs who were rejoicing and dancing and celebrating in the public square at the hangings. And these were people who were their friends. These are people who were their neighbors. These are people who they did business with. And so the question that Paul and I really wanted to ask is, how is this possible that you can get mass amounts of people to just turn in a day? And I think part of that is the opportunity that an authoritarian, in this case, Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party, saw as opportunistic for them to really take control and seize the moment and target the Jewish community in making these empty promises for Arabs that were there. And so they went along with it. So Paul and I, in the book, we're talking about this as an example, saying, you know, this didn't just happen in Iraq. This happened in Bosnia towards the Muslim community there who were attacked by the Serbian Christians. This happened in Rwanda, where the Tutsis were massacred by the Hutus. This happened in Cambodia, where the Cambodian urban community were massacred by the rural community. It's happening in modern times. And so we can point to the leaders and blame the leaders, but ultimately we're looking to those people and saying, how did those people just allow their power and control to, and their responsibility to just be absolved and go along with such horrific acts? And so these were the questions that were really driving us. My grandfather was abducted by the government. Everything was taken from him. And my family had to leave without even knowing whether or not he had survived. He went into a jail called the Palace of No Return, because any prisoner who went in never came out. Even today, we have no confirmation of his death or what happened. But now with some declassified CIA reports, we know that there was really horrific torture that was occurring in those jails. In fact, they were called torture parties by Saddam Hussein. It was horrific. And so these things happen, and it could happen again. We have the propensity for good and evil within all of us. All of us have that possibility. But we ultimately, as the individual, have to choose which path we want to go on.
Absolutely. There was an interesting part in the book, actually, where you raised the point how history has shown when an economy suffers and when people lose something they have, a reliable tactic is to blame, let's say, the minorities or the wealthy or the immigrants for their loss. And that's what these despot leaders will essentially do, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is how they can take control. And the problem is, if you identify that there is this outgroup and they exist outside of you and you don't relate to them and you don't see the shared humanity in them, then it's just adding more fuel to the fire, because then you feel like, oh, I can get away with anything, and they're not really human. They're less than human. They're inferior to me. And we see that even with the Jewish community. We have the left saying that the Jews are colonizers and they're privileged white people. And then on the right, seeing the Jewish population as inferior to them. So it's like, no matter what, but that's the danger, is the mentality of seeing someone as an outgroup, those people. And that's where the language and the perceptions are so dangerous, because you don't see them as individuals. And this is the rise of discrimination and race wars that we're even seeing today. It is really no different. We say those anything, those Black people, those Asian people, those Jewish people, those Muslim people, whatever you want to call them, those privileged white people, those privileged white males, those women, anything, whoever you want to put it at the end of it. That's a danger, because you're not seeing the likeliness and that shared humanity. There's a lot of research on discrimination. And one of the things that really stands out to me is this homogeneity versus heterogeneity. We tend to see our group that we belong to as lots of different individuals with lots of different rich backgrounds and lots of diversity. We tend to see outgroups, those who are different from us, as very similar to each other. So all Jews are greedy. That's one belief. All Blacks are dangerous. All women are unsophisticated and emotional. Whatever it is, whatever that discriminatory or racial rhetoric that you have in your mind is. But the danger is that you're lumping them all together and you think that they're all the same. You're not actually seeing the individual differences, but you can see it within your own in-groups. So that's why a lot of race relations and conflict resolution, especially intergroup conflict resolution, they really work towards bring those individuals together so they can start to see that there's similarities, and there's lots of variability within those groups. Not all people think the same. Not all people act the same. Not all people behave the same. Not all people vote the same. They're all different.
And when we think about the escalating war between Israel and Palestine, does that bring the question of whether lessons have actually been learned?
That's a really great question. The war in the Middle East has been going on for so long. It's so historical and ingrained and embedded in the human psyche and the people that live there. I have family that lives in Israel. In my work in forensic work, I work with all kinds of people. I've had the opportunity to evaluate Arabs from all over the Middle East, from different countries. And there's such an inherent conflict that is going on, and I can't help not see the trauma. And so there's just layers and layers and layers of collective, individual, historical, intergenerational trauma. And another theme that I continue to see is, just because I'm touched so closely by it, is there's this argument of legitimacy, that if one group feels that they're being legitimized by the world, that automatically delegitimizes the other. And so there's this constant push and pull to get the world to see their point of view and why they're right and the other is wrong. And a lot of the tensions are also fueled by this need for this vengeful political push and this retributive sense of justice that I was talking about earlier, is this eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. You deny me, I'm going to hurt you. And you never recuperate from a mentality like that. It just becomes so ingrained and so layered. And so one of the things I often talk about is restorative justice really is a path towards fostering change. And I think we can see this historically, where there is a sense of restored justice. You can never heal that pain. It doesn't go away. It remains, and there's a grief, and probably through generations, there can be more work that's done. But the more trauma that's brought to the forefront in our lifetime is just creating more of that propensity for that conflict and that hurt and that pain and that trauma, and it just being so raw. The effects of war is never a positive thing. And so it takes time to heal.
Regarding the psychology of terrorism, why does it happen and what can be done to prevent it?
I think that people feel at a loss when they feel like they have nothing left to gain except martyring themselves. Now, part of this could be the addictive ideology that we're talking about, this radicalized ideology, and there is a process of indoctrination. And there are also vulnerability factors when we're looking at who is more likely to be indoctrinated. And those tend to be people who feel isolated, people who feel a lack of belonging, that sense of invisibility, or that they have now something that they're holding onto that possibly can restore some meaning or purpose in their life, because before it felt very purposeless. And maybe it's helping to restore something that was lost. And especially if they're being promised something, whether it's a promise in the afterlife, or if it's, say, like the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, if it's that Hamas is promising to give your family some money if you go on a suicide mission, that there might be something that you feel like is being restored. And so what I would want to do is really look at, if I was working with those people, is really doing a deep dive and trying to understand, how do they see the world? How do they see the conflict? How is it that they got to the solution that my only option is a suicide mission to kill and hurt and commit terror and violence against these outgroup members? And the fact that they see these outgroup members as not human, that they don't have that shared humanity within them, and that it somehow is justified. And so there's such a danger to that permeating radicalized ideology. And I'd want to look at, what are they being told? What is it that they believe? Why are they not seeing these alternative facts and evidence? Why are they not seeing pro-social opportunities that they could affect the change that they're wanting in their lives through other means or other avenues rather than sacrificing their life or committing a terrorist act or a suicide bombing? And what options or constrained options are they perceiving? What are they missing?
And in the book, you speak on how we can lose our agency, but also how we can get it back. And you list 7 codes on how one can own their agency. Do you mind touching on some of these, Emily?
Yeah, definitely. So know your truth is very important. We talked about being able to look and discern information that you're getting so that you're not just believing anything that you're being told, and you're really holding yourself accountable to what your perceptions are. So you're not just mind controlled, and your uniqueness entitles you the right to begin anew. I see people in prison who are sentenced to spend the rest of their lives in prison. When I go in and evaluate them, I see a whole variety of people. So some of them, when I assess them and they describe their crime and their victims, it's as though it happened yesterday, and it's maybe been decades that has passed. And there's really no change in their narrative. There's no change or shift. And it's just such an immature development that they're stunted in their growth. They have not shifted at all. And that's a problem. Maybe they're not accessing the resources, or maybe the resources aren't equipped to help them as well because of the complexity of their personality or psychiatric disturbances and other things that might be going on for them. Maybe they're really resistant to change, but there are things that are keeping them stuck. Alternatively, I also see people who have grown immensely. You see the remorse, you see the guilt and the shame and the recognition of the countless victims, not just the person that they potentially murdered, but also those people's families and their community and the other people. And there's this ripple effect that other people who have witnessed the aftermath of the violence, whether it's first responders or other people working in the justice system. So it's never finite. You're never just hurting one person. There's all kinds of people who are affected by violence and murder and homicide. And so when I see these people and I see the growth in them, even if it doesn't change their life sentence, it's remarkable. And I was actually talking to an attorney about this the other day, and she was asking me, what do you think that is, that one person just remains stuck and the other person can grow immensely? And I believe it's the will and the human spirit. And Viktor Frankl would argue the same thing. He survived intense horror and atrocities as a concentration camp survivor. He lost every living member of his family, and he was very fortunate to have survived. And what he experienced and witnessed and went through was just not a life that we can even fathom in our lifetime. And yet he had the willpower to survive, to write his book. And he said, nobody can author my book except me. And the only person who knows it, it's all up here. It's in me. And he said, there is this will to live, this will to survive. And that willpower, it's up to each and every one of us to know what our meaning is, to know what our purpose in our life is. And this is where Paul and I wrote Meaning Over Happiness as one of the lessons and ideals. We sometimes get caught in thinking of our own self, and, you know, it can be nice to only be so superficially oriented and egocentrically oriented. And that's a privilege we can say here in what we have and the abundance of what we have today. But find meaning over happiness. You're going to find something that is more fulfilling and preserving of yourself lifelong. And that will help you in creating a life that's worth living.
It's funny that you mentioned of the 7 ideals, the finding meaning over happiness one, because that was one of the ones that I highlighted like triple times. It really resonated with me. I thought it was fantastic. And there was a quote you mentioned in it as well, which I'm kind of paraphrasing, but it was just the first step for a victim is to identify the choices they have rather than be constrained by the limitations. And it was one of those moments where I was listening to the audiobook and I was like, wow, that one there, fantastic. So yeah, really enjoyed that part, actually. So last question I wanted to ask you, Emily, is how has the people you've worked with taught you that happiness is an inside job?
I see people from, gosh, all kinds of walks of life. I also do evaluations for the immigration court. And yeah, I hear such horrific stories of people who are victims of sex trafficking or survive such horrific circumstances in their home country and are seeking asylum in the U.S. And I just think, wow, they're so incredibly resilient. It is so awe-inspiring for me to be working with people like that and to hear that willpower and that they see we, not me. They're not so self-focused and they see the shared humanity and they don't even blame their captors. They don't blame those who took advantage of them when they were being smuggled even, or those who held them ransom. And it's amazing that they can still persevere and not have that deep hate and resentment and anger at the world. They've suffered so many injustices, and here they are, like, constantly fighting for their life. I can't even imagine living in survival mode, like pure survival mode, each and every day. Tomorrow is not predictable for them. They're totally constrained and limited by options. And yet they see abundance and optimism and hope, and they're motivated by despair. And it's so inspiring to see that. And I work from an empowerment-based model. And this is one of the things that Paul and I really hone in on in the book is, like, look for strength, look for resilience, change your mindset, look at how you're limiting yourself. And there are so many examples in the world of heroes, like child heroes who survived during the Holocaust, who did incredible things to save family members or to save other Jews. And even with my family, like things that people did, my uncle risked his life going to Denmark, journalist, and writing about what was happening in Iraq because the information wasn't getting out to the world of the Jews being persecuted to such extreme forms. And he had to escape to Iran right after he did that. My father also witnessed the hangings of the Jews, and he also was smuggled through the Kurdish mountains, and he was human smuggled into Iran as well. I mean, there's just such incredible bravery and courage. It's all around us. And I would say to people, be the hero. Don't be the victim. You may have a really powerful victim story, but we can change our narratives and find that power within. And when that transformation happens, especially in the therapy work that I do, when I witness that transformation, it is so awe-inspiring. It is so humbling. And it's so powerful to see and witness. And that's the greatest gift of the work that I do.
That was Dr. Emily Basha, author of the book Addictive Ideologies, Finding Meaning in an Agency When Politics Fail You. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to Dr. Emily for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next one.